You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show, 086 60 25,000, the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. A caller says many in Ireland leave to study veterinary abroad because Ireland requires 600 points where you can study in other countries on less points and return home with the same qualification. Has he any idea if the standard required to enter ATU Letterkenny? Well, you heard the answer there. So there are ways that you can lower the points requirement with other elements of the course. That's the impression I got. I had contact with six Donegal County councillors, says a listener, who more or less said they would be prepared to vote to nominate Maria Steen. But they hummed and hawed about a meeting until it was too late. Anyway, one council nomination would be no good to Maria, but it just shows me that our councillors are not representing all the people. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, if the council's tied up to do their bidding, and isn't the position of president meant to be non-political? The government were afraid of genuine independent debate and excluded all genuine independents. But are you saying that Catherine Connolly's not a true independent? I wouldn't say just because other parties support her that that dilutes her independency, maybe. I don't know. Hi, Greg. You don't know what's flying directly overhead these days. I don't know what it is. It's King 11, United States Air Force. Well, there's quite a bit of back and forth with military planes all of the time, but I don't know specifically what that is. Okay, really, they're not asking what it is. They're pointing out that these are military aircraft. Okay, thank you very much for that. Did anyone notice a low-flying aircraft over Bunkrana yesterday around 11 a.m.? It was a United States Air Force plane. I checked it on flight radar. This is a separate contact. And it's not the first time that I've seen a low-flying plane there. Yeah, the military planes seem to fly a bit lower. I remember noting one of those myself as well. A caller says, so our only option for the presidents are far left and very far left. I, along with many, will be putting Maria Steen on the ballot to show our contempt for the closed shop nature of the election. If our politicians had accepted and implemented the recommendations of the Oireachtas from 1998, the presidential election would be a lot more representative. Disgraceful, anti-democratic politics. I'm not sure spoiling your vote is a protest at all. But it's completely up to you. That's the joy of having your own ballot paper. A caller says, though, for the first time in my life, I won't be voting. I suppose, you know, why would you vote if none of the candidates kind of align to where your way of thinking? That is the problem, maybe, where you have three candidates operating in roughly the same space, though I know Catherine Connolly supporters would say that that is not the case. There are many people out there that won't vote because they don't think there is an alternative that kind of works for them. The presidential election is not very exciting. Debates will be boring. Disappointed that Gareth Sheridan and Maria Steen were blocked. They would have brought a freshness to the debates. My opinion, thank you. We appreciate your opinion. I don't think I'll be tuning into the debates. Although I might, I don't know. Another on this issue. To obstruct a potential candidate from standing as a candidate smacks of the hallmark of a tin pot regime and its media backers running scared of the electorate. Whoever wins the rigged race for president, their majestic mansion in Phoenix Park will always have the dark shadow of the affront of democracy hanging over it from Jim. But as I say, Jim, there's been more independents that have been selected to contest the presidential election than there have been party-affiliated candidates. Is it possible that maybe Maria Steen and her politics and her campaign just didn't resonate with enough independents for them to back her, you know, in the Shannon of the Dáil? That is also a possibility, and arguably that potentially is also democracy. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Right, can you, you know, I'll tell you, I have a lot to get through in this hour, so we'll hold off some of those comments, come back to them in a moment. I just want to mention, though, that there is a coffee morning being held from 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. in the new hall in Falkara. It's an aid of the Donegal Hospice. All are welcome. So that's a coffee morning today until 1:30 a.m. in the new hall in Falkara. Get along, have a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, maybe there's some nice tray bakes there. And also you're raising money for the Donegal Hospice and having a chat to other people and those around you in your community, which is always lovely. Right, it is jackpot today. And, you know, you can always win big on the Vision Ireland Radio Bingo. We chatted on Monday to a lady who collected €2,500, and that was the daily prize. It was a rollover daily prize as well. And really, the great thing about the money you can win on the bingo. The following day, the daily price was back at 400, which is great, isn't it? But today is jackpot day, so good luck if you are playing. Don't forget you can get your books at any time. It's not a club. It's not a gang. It's open to absolutely everyone, and it's to put money in your pockets whilst you have a bit of fun and raise money for Vision Ireland. So there's a lot of talk of coverage of elections and what have you, and an organisation has been scouring both the local and national media over the last while to ascertain the type of coverage the three presidential candidates have been given. Jim Gavin dominates national airways with 34.9% of the share. Catherine Connolly leads overall mentions but tilts negative. Heather Humphreys posts most positive tone locally, strongest in Cork, Cavan and Monaghan. So nationally, Fianna Fáil's Jim Gavin has emerged as the candidate with the strongest national radio footprint in the run-up to the 2025 presidential election, according to new research from Everhayes. Analysis of 2,500 radio clips of over the past 12 weeks show that while independent Catherine Connolly leads overall mentions at 36.3%, Gavin at 33.5% pulls ahead in terms of the national airwaves, with 34.9% of his coverage on national talk formats. By contrast, Connolly's campaign is more heavily weighted to local outlets, 68.6% of our coverage. And Heather Humphreys' profile is even more locally concentrated, 71.3%. What that means, having a clue, but there's the info for you. The editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune is John McAteer, and he's with me now. Hiya, John.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Right, you know, you've seen and covered your fair share of presidential elections. It's 1990 since we have to go back to see a three-horse race. Is it a three-horse race, is it a three-headed horse?
It's a three-headed horse in some ways. I think the campaign began much too late. Today is the first day of campaigning. I mean, we're not preparing for canvassers lining up on our doorsteps or anything like that. There's the odd poster going up, and it's going to be dominated mainly on media. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will be looking towards the 7th of October for the budget day, and how does that resonate? Because the fallout of that budget, and there could be restrictions and cuts there, that could dominate the election campaign. It'll not be about the presidential election at all, if it ever was. And they've been very coy about that. And I think the national debates are beginning this weekend. And
what are they going to debate about?
This is the question. They'll be debating Gaza, Palestine. They'll be debating Trump. Anything and everything but the real issue at hand here. Who is going to make the best president? Who has the best thinking? Who has the best ideas and suggestions? Do you follow in Michael D's footsteps? Do you follow in Mary Robinson's or Mary McAleese's? See, we've been spoiled for choice since 1990, 35 years. You've had three excellent presidents. And mind you had Paddy Hillary before that, who was also a very good president and much more low-key. But like at the end of the day, can you get people out to vote? This is going to be the big question. Last time out, it was just, 44% or just short of it? Very, very low. At the last general election, it was, 59% or slightly under it, with over 600 candidates. Will the public become anyway motivated or energised by the debates? Does any of the three candidates or the three of them combined offer enough to give it enough depth and enough width?
I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where. I mean, the triple lock, I think, will be one. And they might try and paint Catherine Connolly into a caller on Hamas, into a corner on Hamas, but she's kind of, addressed that anyway.
She's addressed it very comprehensively, and that is absolute rubbish. Micheál Martin is trying to paint her as somebody that he just doesn't seem to know what she's talking about. Catherine Connolly is a clinical psychologist. She's a barrister. She's a Gaelic. And, you know, she's a very experienced politician. But to try and ram it down her throat that she hasn't condemned Hamas, of course she has. But she answered a question on the BBC, and it was in relation to Keir Starmer, you know. And it was, you know, would she back his stand as if she needed to, or as if Micheál Martin even needed to back her stand in a two-state solution. And she made it very clear that she wasn't going to get engaged in that. She said it was a matter of for the people of Palestine to make their own decisions. And that's the gist of what she did say. How do you condemn her on that? I mean, everybody has condemned Hamas. It's a total waste of time at this point because, I mean,
But that question was posed...
They're still there.
Yeah, that question was posed to her as if Hamas was formed on that fateful day of October 7th. The question didn't... The question wasn't nuanced whatsoever, and she tried to bring some nuance into it. Whether you agree with her or not, you know, Hamas is not five people. It's a way of thinking. It's an ideology. You can't just eliminate it, even if you wanted to. And Israel are finding that out right now. And that's in no way to speak positively of the organisation in any way, shape, or form. But
absolutely not. I mean, Hamas is a vicious terrorist organisation. Okay, they'll claim to have a mandate that they represent the people of Gaza, but they don't really. They don't really. They have coerced the people of Gaza into their thinking and into spending money. I mean, Gaza has been starved of money for generations. Now, Israel's handling of it has been equally disastrous, murdering people. 68,000 people at least killed, mainly women and children, doesn't answer any questions. And the fact that, you know, in this year of 2025, that world diplomacy cannot change Israel's mind says a lot for the failures of the major organisations like the United Nations, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's your view for sure. Now, just in relation to how we got to there being just three... Since 1990, there have been 13 independent candidates, three from Labour, three from Fine Gael, two from Fianna Fáil, and two from Sinn Féin. Does that prove that the system actually does work if you get the right independent? Or is it this the election whereby the parties were able to actually flex their muscles to show how they actually can control who gets on the ballot paper? So what I'm trying to get at is, you know, were the likes of Gareth Sheridan, Maria Steen and others blocked from getting onto the ballot paper, or did democracy work and their message simply didn't resonate with those that they needed to support them?
They got onto the campaign much, much too late. In 1990, Mary Robinson was in the campaign at the beginning of January. Likewise, Mary McAleese in 1997. The campaigns were... People were engaging with the campaigns because I think it was of the calibre of the candidates at that point. But there was no real attempt to get any campaign up and running this time until about 3 months ago. And Catherine Connolly was talking about it probably at Easter time. Heather Humphreys was nowhere in sight because Mairead McGuinness was going to be the Fine Gael candidate. And Fianna Fáil looked at a stage that they mightn't have a candidate. There was probably talk that they might have a joint candidate with Fine Gael as part of the coalition that they're in. Anyway, they came up with a candidate from well outside the party, and now they have Jim Gavin in there. But no, the campaign just didn't ignite. The question is, can it now ignite? Can the first debate... There's a debate on Virgin Media, I think, in the next number of days, and that's how much up to speed we are with it. I think it's maybe the 29th, is it? And then the Week in Politics on Sunday week is dealing with it. Now, there's going to be no mad rush to spend big money on the debate to see how these first two debates work out for them. Because has the three candidates combined, have they that ability, that skill and that political talent to hold the attention of the public for a couple of hours? You know, I mean, last time out was quite different. You had three of the former Dragons. You had Peter Casey, you had Gavin Duffy, and you had Sean Gallagher in there, and you had Joan Freeman. They were all good debaters. Michael D. Higgins, excellent. And like at the end of the day, you had, the debates weren't just 100%, but they were enough to hold the attention of the public.
How do Heather Humphreys and Jim Gavin debate anything? I mean, one's Fianna Fáil, one's Fine Gael. Jim Gavin's, you know, not got a background in politics. I'm not sure either or will try and, you know, land a big punch on the other. So how do they even debate?
You can't have a good debate with three people. This is where Maria Steen and Gareth Sheridan would have added so much to it. I don't think anybody saw either of the two of them winning an election campaign, but they would have added a new dimension and they would have held the three candidates to account. That's not going to be happening, you see. And this is the importance of having had those two candidates. But I mean, the decisions were made otherwise. They were rejected within a fairly narrow remit. Gareth Sheridan looked fairly good middle of last week that he could have got two extra councillors in the Midlands. He didn't get them. Likewise, Maria Steen probably worked extremely hard, but when she failed to get people like Michael McDowell on board, it was a lost cause. Paddy Tobin done all the running there with Aintu, but he just could not sell the message. And Steen would have been, she's an absolutely brilliant debater. She is a barrister, but she has that turn of phrase and she's very, very quick thinking. She's great in front of the cameras. She would have brought out all the fault lines in all of the three existing candidates, and there's no doubt about that. Now, I don't see either of the three of them punching too many holes in each other's egos or anything like that. I can't see the debates being all that enlivening. It isn't that the three candidates are probably worthy of being where they are, but will they hold that attention span that's needed from the public? As of now, I cannot see that happening.
What does it mean if you have three candidates that are left-leaning? What does it mean to turnout, right? So there's lots of people listening to this show and swathes around the country that would be more conservative in their thinking, that may have voted certain ways in certain referenda. You know, they don't come out and vote at all, do they? So what does that mean? Or maybe they do, it's a question, not a statement. So what does that mean to turnout then?
You see, yeah. You see, despite the activity of the last one, and Michael D. Higgins was going to be a shoo-in anyway. His popularity was huge. But, I mean, the vote was hugely disappointing. It was the lowest on record up to now. And the big danger here is that people will not engage.
I think it's going to be in the 30s. I genuinely think the turnout's going to be in the 30s.
My gut instinct is that it could be in the mid-30s, unless something dramatic happens. And with the three candidates, they're all well. Jim Gavin, we can't comment on too much because we don't know him. Heather Humphreys will be a very solid performer. She was a minister for 11 years. She's a councillor since 2004. She brings a wealth of experience and knowledge and diplomacy into it. She's a very, very popular politician. So was Catherine Connolly. She's a very quiet way. She has a huge uphill task, despite that she has the whole left-leaning coalition behind her. That might work if they can all get motivated in their own particular areas to go out and canvass doorsteps, because you won't get elected without doing that. Mm. You can talk for all you want to on television and radio and all that kind of stuff, like us talking here now. On the day, will people decide, we'll not bother? Somebody's going to get elected. We'll just leave it at that. Will the younger generation bother voting at all? That is the big one. Say the under 45s.
I genuinely can't see under 45s coming out in there. There's so much dissatisfaction or disillusionment or disinterest in politics, and then you get to the presidential area whereby, you know, you might try and argue some significance for it, but even, you know, those who are very strict in certain points, like Catherine Connolly, for an example, you know, as already said, she's unlikely to really exercise the only real power a president has. So what's the point of it other than shaking hands with footballers, welcoming heads of state, etc.? Some of that's kind of opinion, some of it's just questioning what people out there might be thinking and whether or not it's worth voting.
Well, the president has a fairly important role. They're the head of state. They're, like, effectively, they are Ireland's diplomatic voice in every nation across the world where they're invited to. And they make themselves known. A president will develop their own presence and make their own statements accordingly, as our three previous ones have proven. And they have brought a whole new dimension to it, that you're not tied within all the constraints of the Constitution. You can travel outside of that as long as you don't try to overthrow the country, because the government can't do very much about that. But the three candidates you have there have a huge amount of work to get a message out there to say to us, please come out and vote.
Okay, so who
vote for somebody?
Who wins and how? I imagine that Catherine Connolly would require a massive first preference to stand a chance. You know, Jim Gavin, obviously, I imagine, is going to do very well in the biggest population on the island, and that's in Dublin. But how will he do elsewhere? And then, obviously, we know that Heather Humphreys is a popular politician. So break it down for us. Who does well where? Who gets over the line, in your view?
What look at the fact of the last general election in November. Again, a low turnout of under 60% for the first time. Fianna Fáil at 481,000, Fine Gael 458,000, Sinn Féin 418,000, and Independence at 291,000. You break it down on those lines, how many of those will come out and vote again? How many of them are more disillusioned than they were last November? What did we expect last November? We didn't expect a change of government, that's for sure. We didn't expect the Greens to be annihilated. We didn't expect Michael Lowry's independence calling the shots to form the government. Those are the things that happened there. Are people happy that that happened? Will they be happy that a group of rural independents who should have had really no say in government occupy two senior junior ministries? And there's a whole lot going for them there. Are people happy with that? Are people happy with the current status from the point of view of rising prices and challenging? There are record numbers of people in arrears with their ESB bills.
But does Catherine Connolly go after the other two candidates on those issues?
She will, though,
in the debates? It doesn't. I don't get that impression from her.
No, I don't either. Now, this is where her advisors would have to come in. Probably the first of the opinion polls should be out this weekend or early next week.
So does she have to make the campaign like a referendum on the government? That's the only way she gets over the line, isn't it?
It's going to turn out that way anyway. That's the way people are going to vote. And a lot of it is going to happen after the 7th of October. The budget is going to be a real game changer for people's thinking. This is the first time that we've had it. And this is the COVID thing, that COVID impact is still there. 2018, a lot has happened in that time. Would Michael D. Higgins, if he was running this time, get the same kind of a vote again? I don't think so. Because people's thinking about politics, the numbers voting are falling. I mean, you know, in the 1980s and all that, Fianna Fáil was up to 50%. Fine Gael, their height was around 37-38%. It's a huge... But now, between them, they have 42%. You know, like on those figures, if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is 42%, independents then will have a big say if they can get their act together across all the political parties, from Sock Dems to Labour to People Before Profit to Social Democrats. That's a big ask, because even though they're backing the president, get them out.
There's some people though that could, you know, maybe vote for Catherine Connolly because they support Sinn Féin, but wouldn't want to do anything that might be endorsing the Social Democrats, or vice versa for that matter. The coalition of the left will be tested greatly, I think. And also, a lot of people talking about spoiling the votes, John. You know, at the end of the day, at an election, when the elections are being counted, there's a pile of spoiled votes. No one really pays any attention. There's no pictures taken of them, other than what you might feel you're doing individually. You're not really achieving anything other than really not blocking the person that you might not want to be elected. Like, spoiling your vote really is irrelevant, because, say, for instance, you didn't want Greg Hughes to be elected president and you wrote down John McAteer to spoil your vote. That's great for me, because, you know, that's another vote not against me. So, you know, spoiling your vote could be handing the election, if you were to vote, to someone you're not interested in.
The problem is, and this is a big, big issue, the spoiled votes are done because people are marking one for the first candidate and one for the next, or two X's. The numbers of ballot papers that are defaced and messages written on them is very, very, very low. It would be less than 1%, I would imagine. I mean, there's just a handful of them, really, that go to the polling station to deliberately spoil their vote. That's something that, you know, if it's worth your while, to be part of a democracy and that to shout to the polling station on the day of the election to go and spoil your vote, you're not making any point at all.
Well, there could be 30,000 of them sitting on a table in the count centre, and all it is doing is votes that are not opposing someone you might be against. It really doesn't count towards anything. But as I say, maybe it's enough for someone to do it personally.
If people are motivated to do that, politicians and the political parties need to look at what they're doing. I mean, what has the government been doing for people? I mean, how do people see the government that was elected last November? We've not heard very much from them. Has the housing crisis eased? Has the hospital situation eased insofar as waiting lists and queues at A&E? We're coming into winter now. People will be looking at their own personal situation financially, and they'll be asking themselves, can we vote for this person? Can we vote for that person on the basis that there might be a more value, to us in our thinking and in our way of thinking?
Okay.
Do they believe that the government is already failing them? That'll be a big motivating factor. But at the end of the day, as you said earlier on there, we could be down in the mid-30s for a poll, and that would be a disaster. Mm. Because, you know, the fact is that, first of all, the registers are totally out of kilter. Art O'Leary has already said on your show that there may be 500,000 people too many on the register. I wonder what have they been doing about that there? Because all of that plays into it, you know.
All right. Listen, John, it's fascinating as always. We'll touch base again after we get through the debates or what have you and see. I just think, you know, there's so many people who perhaps don't feel represented by any of the candidates. Will they vote at all? And this is not any criticism of the candidates. It's literally just where they stand in the political space. They're three fine people, I'm sure. So I don't want anyone to think it's me slagging anyone off. That's not the motivation. All right, John, thanks very much. Great to make your paper this week. I'm down in the bottom corner of one of the picture specials, which is lovely. Thank you for that.
Oh, lovely. Absolutely brilliant.
Look after yourself. John McAteer, there, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune, 086 60 25,000. Now, thank you for all your calls and comments coming in. Really appreciated it. Really appreciate it, by the way. Hi, Greg. That American plane that flew over Donegal yesterday, it left Belfast. That's why it was so low. So it was still ascending then, I take it. Another, I hear on your news about burning solid fuel for heat. If the government of this country want cleaner fuel, they would need to get their finger out of you know where and provide cheaper ways to heat houses. I'm a 66-year-old. The council have air-to-water heating in some of their houses now being built, but I would like to ask them, where do they think older people are going to get the money to heat these houses? It's very sore on electricity to heat these houses. I, for one, cannot afford this type of bill on my pension. It will be a cold winter this year, and there are no solar panels on these houses either. I suppose any of these heating systems begin to make more sense, I think, when a house is very well insulated, because then you require on less. A choice between two Liberals and one hard left Liberal. Spoil your vote and give Maria Steen number one for a real alternative. Again, we've discussed whether or not that makes a difference, but it's completely up to you. I hope that it will be noted that Charlie McConlogue was Minister for Agriculture at the time Letterkenny was chosen for this college. I hope the people who abused and vilified him will maybe find it in their hearts to give him some credit for his input into getting his great facility to Letterkenny. I'd love to have him on the show to talk about it. Seems like LGBTQ and the supporters are going to be calling the shots on who's entitled to stand for president of this country for the long future. I don't see how that is the case. Like, you know, there's a lot of very negative language against people that are our brothers, our sisters, our aunts, our daughters, our sons, our work colleagues, our friends. You know, like that LGB has become some sort of a slur against people. I mean, these are, you know, their rights have been hard fought for and hard won, and these are people of our community. And I can't imagine that any texter doesn't have someone around them who is part of this community and would not like to be grouped in, you know, with some sort of group think. They're just our regular people all around us. But anyway, they say they're going to call the shots on who stands for president in this country for the long future. Maria was plagued by the media in her past issues, but interestingly, they wouldn't challenge Heather Humphreys on the subject, considering the Orange Order she supports. Again, I don't see what is wrong with someone supporting the Orange Order or her husband having any role in the Orange Order or not. Maybe I'm being naive here. But anyway, fair play to Ken Flynn, a gay man himself who endorsed Maria, and he wouldn't allow the liberal narrative dictate who he should choose. A caller says, it's not democracy. I'll be voting for Maria Steen, spoiling my vote for the first time in 40 years. Another, surely those talking of spoiling their vote should in fact vote Catherine Connolly to show Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael that we are sick of them. I would urge the vote spoilers to think more pragmatically. And listen, there's an initial reaction after yesterday that maybe people will choose differently. Maybe they'll watch the debates. I don't know. Coming up after 11, Paul McLaughlin is in studio. It's the last of our season. Aww. But you know what? The one thing about life and seasons and nature, it'll be no time again before Paul is back in. We might speak to him over the winter on individual issues, but for his regular other weekly call in. So if you have any questions about your garden, still amazing growth in the grass, by the way. But anyway, the nighttime temperatures have dipped, so maybe not so going forward. Any questions for Paul? The usuals, you know, your gardens, your hedges, your lawns, your trees, your window boxes, your balcony, your windowsill, your sunroom, your bedroom. Any questions to do with growing, nurturing, caring, to do with the garden in and around it, let us know. 086 60 25,000. We're joined now by our resident historian, Dr. Joe Kelly, and we're focusing on Uachtaráin na hÉireann. No coincidence, or else an astonishing coincidence, Joe. Morning to you, Máirtín Mhaith, and Walter Gomai.
Good morning. Listening.
My who? Right, okay. What is the President of Ireland? When was this established? What's the role?
Well, it was really only established in with the Constitution of 1937, when we had a new Bunreacht or a new constitution. And the constitution obviously had to decide how we're going to have division of powers within this country. How are we going to be governed? How are we going to be ruled? And really, what's interesting is when we got independence in 1922, we didn't have a president. So from 1922 to 1937, even though we were the Irish Free State and we had a constitution of 1922, there was no president, and that wasn't allowed because what we had was a governor general from the king at the time, George V, and then Edward VIII. Both of them had a representative as part of the treaty of 1921-22 that we could not have anybody other than that, the Governor General, and they resided in what was the Vicar Lodge, or what now is known as Aras an Uachtaráin. And the last one of the Governor Generals was a man by the name of Don Lobuhla, who refused to stay there and refused to take the fee or the stipend, the financial remuneration for it, because he was too much of a Republican and didn't want to have anything to do with it. So when the new constitution was being formed, De Valera changed a lot of things, and one of the things he did was he got rid of the Governor General. He changed the title of Ireland from Saoirstead na hÉireann, the Irish Free State, to ERA, the country of Ireland. We weren't a republic until 49, so ERA we weren't allowed to because of the treaty. England wouldn't necessarily allow us to do that. And one of the things he made sure was that we would implement things that would distance ourselves from British imperialism and the role of the regal role in Irish politics. So really that is the beginning of our presidency in 1938.
And just in relation to that, we see in other countries, say France for an example, where we have presidents and then we have a government, and it's structured completely different, and there's more power given to the president there. Have we created a model, or what model did we follow, or who determined sort of the actual expanse of the role of president versus, you know, what we see elsewhere?
Yeah, a very good question. And to be honest with you, what I'd really need to do is give maybe do a show with you.
A deep dive into that one elsewhere.
On the actual constitutional role of the president and the functions and the competencies of the president. But just to answer your question very quickly, the president in other countries, for example, France and America, have far more powers as such. Our Taoiseach is, so to speak, the person with the powers, the governmental powers. It's a titular or a representative role, a wee bit like what it was in the Governor General previous to our own president, whereby it was more a representative role. Now, there are powers and competencies that the present president has. In fact, there are some powers in the Constitution that no president to date has used. So it's something that a lot of people don't know enough about. They know a little bit about because we've had Michael Dee, and we maybe people remember other presidents, but they actually maybe aren't always aware of the constitutional role of the president. In fact, I would argue that maybe some of our existing presidential candidates don't even know.
But just so say, for instance, one of the roles that the president was given at some point, right, was to, if they believed a law or a change to the legislation, if they believed that it didn't sort of that it went against our constitution, that they could refer that to check it, right? Yeah. Like, was that always just notional, never to be used? Or I'm just wondering, did our founding fathers, in inverted commas, believe that the role of president should be more important and that they would be able to hold a government to an account? It's just the fact that that power has never been invoked. Why was it ever placed there in the first place if it's never to be used? Because now what you're told is that, right, there's better ways to challenge it. And if you refer something to the Supreme Court and it's upheld, that's it. It can never be challenged ever again and blah, da, blah, da, blah, right? So, but in reality, was it... Someone put that into the role of president for a reason. It's never been exercised, as far as I'm aware. Why?
Well, firstly, there are, according to the Constitution, there are roughly five. I mean, it depends how you interpret it. There's five main primary roles, functions of the president. And one of those that they have discretion on is the right to refer a bill after consultation with the Council of State to the Supreme Court. It's a safety measure, which is a very good measure in fairness. But once it's been referred to the Supreme Court, it can never be challenged again. Michael D. Higgins did it there with the judicial review, the appointment of people to the high courts. He did that in October 23, if my memory is correct.
Cool. Right.
It's been done a number of times. And in fact, to my memory, I think 8 times while being referred to the Supreme Court, it has actually been found to be unconstitutional. Some of the laws coming from the Dáil, that is the Shannon and the Dáil, going to the president, 8 times what they've proposed has been considered unconstitutional. So in a way, the president can act in a way that to protect the legal structure of the country. Mm. But at the end of the day, and again, I'll maybe do this again with you, the president is subject to the government nearly in all matters.
Well, they can't leave the country, can they, without permission?
No, they can't. And lots of things that they can't do without. Basically, what the president is a titular role, and that they must be in line with the government. The government makes the laws, even, for example, matters of finance and monies and budgets, absolutely. But you asked a very powerful question there about, was this what was intended by the fathers of the state? When the presidential, when the referendum on the constitution, the new constitution was proposed, believe it or not, 4 areas, Sligo, Wicklow, somewhere in Dublin and West Cork, voted against the accepting of the new constitution 1937, which is very interesting. And one of the fears that was expressed, particularly by the Fine Gael members of government at the time, one man was from Fitzgerald from Carlow, and another one was O'Sullivan from Kerry, he was the Minister for Education, was concerned that the president had too many powers and that they feared that if De Valera then became president, that he would draw onto himself more powers than what was perceived in the constitution itself.
Well, maybe that leads to, why is it not a direct election then? What would have been the motivation for it not to be a direct election whereby it would be a popular vote of the people to allow those to be on the ballot to eventually obviously go before the people for an election? Why was has the process of getting on the ballot always been so convoluted? Because it does seem to be appealing to the classes and open to a little bit of massaging, let me put it like that.
Well, it comes down to how we see our act as members. That is our senators and our TDs. You see, I always understood, as it is the philology of the word chak, the dala, is messenger to the dial. But what we have, and I've said this before in your show, we have a DT, a dala chakter. They are no longer representing us. They're representing agenda and coming down with their agenda to us. And we've seen this now with this presidential election. Likewise, the county councils, we have 31 local authorities in Ireland. You need only four of those to get a presidential nomination. And I think councillors have to have a real hard think. They have been given a it's in the constitution, a constitutional privilege that you and I haven't been given, Greg. Gardaí haven't been given.
If I was a councillor, I would have insisted to at least have had a meeting, because I think it's so important to actually to be given that right. Now, from there, whether or not you nominate someone that you don't agree with, that's a different conversation. But to not actually exercise the right to have a meeting is I don't think it's very representative of the people. Maybe I'm being naive.
Well, again, this is maybe back then to where we're looking at how the constitution was formed and what the purpose of that was. And if you look basically at every president we have had, bar probably Carol O'Daly and Douglas Dehija, they have been more or less political. And see, maybe people aren't aware of this, but in our constitution, one of the articles in the beginning of our constitution is no citizen of this country is allowed to take a title. So Sir Bob Geldof looking for the presidential role is a conflict, because as a republic, everybody is equal. So we can't have titles. Nobody is above anybody else. Yeah, everybody is equal. So you can't have Sir and Lord in a republic. In a republic, everybody is equal. And that has been the basis of our understanding of our constitution and everybody in this country. But, and I teach children, and I've taught thousands and thousands of children over my years, decades of a teacher, and I've always told the children to aspire to what they dream. And one of the dreams that any young boy or girl in this country could have and should have is the right to become the first citizen of the country, the president of the country. In a republic, every citizen should be able to have that aspiration, should they so wish. But it's clear now that that is no longer the case. It is now belongs to the political elite. And what they have done is they have surrounded the presidency and controlled it and manipulated to them to their own benefit and use. And that makes it a very, very precarious situation. Okay. And I'm asking, are we living in a republic anymore, or are we living in a dictatorship?
Okay, well, let me tease that question out with you a little bit further after we take a break and the news. So Joe's going to rejoin us. He's been very generous with his time. He's going to rejoin us at about 2 minutes past 11 after these.